Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Mort Shelby, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, James Konacek, Karen Carbone, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, David Coyne, Kate Foster, Michael John Casey, Tim Getman, Scott McCormick, and Michael Raplogel. Deathlands number 37, Demons of Eden.
What did you see, lover?
Trouble.
What's out there?
Stay down, Christy. Your hair might as well be a signal flare.
Sorry. What's going on?
We've got a strange wheeled vehicle with a white broadcloth sail.
Sail? It's a wind wagon?
Yeah, but that's not the trouble part. Take a look if you have to, but keep your head down.
Christy cautiously poked her head up over the crest of the bluff. She stared at the scene below. The prairie schooner, or wind wagon, matched the configurations of a longboat. It was about 12 feet long from bow to stern, and a tall mast with a furled sail was set amidships, stretching upward 20 feet. A pair of maneuvering sails was folded like wings against the sides of the craft. Four spoked wooden wheels lifted the keel several feet above the ground. Mounted astern was a huge, wire-encased four-bladed fan and a diesel engine. Flapping from the rigging attached to the mast were clumps of human hair, finger bones, and shriveled ears. A black pennant fluttered from the masthead, bearing the outline of a scarlet skull.
Pirates?
Not just any pirates, either.
Yes. They're emblems of the Red Cadre. I heard tales of them even back when I lived in Harmony in Colorado.
Yep. I've heard they have a whole fleet of those wind wagons.
You think Hatchet Jack is with them?
I don't think so. Their leader wouldn't go out on such a small boat. He might be close. It's not like the Cadre to just go out alone like this.
The schooner stood in the center of a small cup formed by three sloping bluffs and a dry creek bed. To the left was a grove of poplar trees, running raggedly between the farthermost hills. Three ponies were hobbled nearby, grazing on the tough sawgrass. Two of the animals bore saddles made of wood and blankets. The third was apparently a pack horse. A huge dark mound lay at the rear of the schooner. It was a buffalo carcass, waiting to be skinned. Its woolly hide was still intact, which was more than could be said for the Cheyenne man tied spread-eagled to the wooden spokes of the schooner's rear wheel. Christy had heard stories of peeling, a torture certain marauder bands reserved exclusively for Indians. The pirates had practiced the ritual with great enthusiasm on the man. Entire strips of flesh had been flayed from his torso and upper arms. Great red raw patches were exposed to flies and the late afternoon sunlight. Though she felt acidic bile climbing up her throat in a burning column, Christy studied the victim for any sign of movement. She saw none. His swarthy face was a livid mask of dried blood that had flowed from the crimson patch atop his skull, where his scalp had been torn away. Christy squeezed her eyes shut as the bluff beneath her seemed to spin like a cork caught in a whirlpool. She had seen many monstrous deeds during her life in Deathlands, and had narrowly escaped similar fates more than once. Still, she had never grown accustomed to the horrors people inflicted on others, simply for the sake of seeing them suffer. It took a great effort for her to open her eyes again. She sensed Ryan watching her, gauging her reaction. Christy gritted her teeth and focused her gaze on the woman tied to the front wheel. She wasn't spread-eagled. Rather, she sat on the ground, her back against the hub, her wrists tied to the spokes, level with her ears. She was totally naked, and her knees were drawn up to her chest and pressed tightly together. Christy couldn't see what her face was like, but her skin was white, though dabbed red in places. Her head was bowed, and her hair, though hayrick tangled, was cut short, and dark blonde in color. A pirate strutted past her, carrying an earthenware jug. He ignored her, and she did the same for him. Another marauder walked over to the Indian, pushed his coat aside, fumbled briefly, and urinated on the man's blood-drenched pant leg. Christy squinted her eyes and studied the pirates. The man with the jug was huge and ugly. His swart, flat-nosed face was embraced by a square-cut beard of an unidentifiable color. Gray threads were interspersed with tobacco-stained streaks. He looked to be about 50 years old. The other three were undistinguished in attitude and appearance. None was tall. In fact, the one who was emptying his bladder looked shorter than even Jack Lauren's 5 feet 5 inches. One of the pirates was beefy, and a potbelly swelled over the waistband of his trousers. All of them had long, wild-looking hair. The only firearms Christy spied among them were a battered Winchester repeating carbine, cradled carelessly in the crook of the tall man's arm, and a single-shot muzzle loader propped against the stern of the schooner. The stock and barrel of the Winchester were patched and bound in two places, with shrunken and stitched deer hide. The other weapons were a variety of knives, nail-studded clubs, and a short-handled axe. The tall man handed the jug to the beefy, swag-bellied man and wiped his beard with blood-stained fingers.
This is terrible.
I know.
What are we going to do about it?
Ride in and kill him.
JB, Mildred, Doc, and Jack watched Ryan and Christy slide down the hillside. JB took off his eyeglasses and stowed them in one of the many capacious pockets of his coat. The brim of his battered and bullet-holed fedora was pulled down over his forehead. With his left hand, he held the reins of a roan mare, and his right hand rested lightly on the trigger guard of the Uzi, hanging from a lanyard around his neck. Though Jack's white, scarred face was as impassive as ever, his ruby eyes glittered at the sense of danger. The young albino's stance reminded Christy of a vicious snow leopard, straining at its leash. The other two people tending the horses were the only ones who hadn't been born into the war-ravaged remnants of the United States of America. Dr. Mildred Wyeth and Dr. Theophilus Tanner had been thrust into Deathlands due to pre-nuke-cost technology. A stocky black woman with beaded, plaited hair, Mildred Wyeth looked as though she were in her mid-30s, but chronologically, she was well over a century old. A medical doctor and former specialist in cryogenic sciences, Mildred had entered a hospital in late 2000 for minor surgery, but an allergic reaction to the anesthetic had necessitated her body being placed in cryonic stasis until a treatment could be found. It never was. The world was blown apart before she was revived, and she slept like a fly trapped in amber for nearly 100 years. Ryan and his companions had found and freed her. They had brought her back to life, into a world she had never dreamed existed. From her perspective, she had gone to sleep as a 36-year-old professional woman, and awakened a moment later to the devastating realization her 100th birthday had come and was long gone. Amazingly, the ill effects of the anesthetic had disappeared. Other than her skills as a medic, Mildred had also proved herself invaluable as a tenacious survivalist. She had won a silver medal for free pistol shooting in the last ever Olympic Games, and she was the best shootist that any of the companions had ever seen. Doc Tanner, unlike Mildred, who had bobbed unknowingly down the temporal stream, was the subject of a cold-hearted scientific practice known in pre-dark days as trawling. Since the 1940s, American military scientists, and their counterparts in other countries, had tried to reconcile relativistic physics with quantum mechanics. By the late 1990s, the reconciliation attempts had spawned the super-secret experiment known as the totality concept. There were several subdivisions of the experiment, such as Over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus, and finally, Operation Kronos. With the use of a complex meta-transfer device called a gateway, the project scientists had tried time and again to snatch subjects from a past temporal line and trawl them to the present. Their only success was a man from 1895. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, Ph.D., scientist and scholar, was plucked from the bosom of his beloved family and deposited in a sterile subterranean chamber a century down the timeline. Though he learned all he could about the 20th century, Doc never abandoned the hope of returning to his wife and two children. His constant attempts to return to his own era so angered the whitecoats of Operation Kronos that they eventually used him as a trawling subject again. Rather than send him back, they opted to transfer him nearly a century in the future. The wrenching changes left their marks on Doc. In his worn frock coat, his skinny frame looked gaunt, and his face, old beyond his actual years. 16-year-old Jack Lauren had all the hard, bitter experience of a man twice his age. He had whiter-than-white skin, with fearsome ruby eyes, and a shock of blindingly white hair. He possessed incredible hand and eye coordination, and favored bladed weapons over guns. Scars from several near-fatal encounters marked his body, the least of which curved up from the corner of his mouth and across his high-planed face. Though Jack had buried two sets of families during his young life, he hid the tragedies behind a taciturn mask and an eerily calm, detached manner. Ryan Cotter and J.B. Dix had been companions for many years, since they traveled the Deathlands in a pair of war wags with the legendary traitor. Tall and hard-muscled, with a scar running down his face from the edge of the patch over his left eye, Ryan was a natural-born leader. J.B. was an armorer, and he had served traitor's war wags as a weaponsmith. His wiry, short frame and unmemorable face disguised a devious mind and a facility with weapons that approached the artistic. By contrast, Christy Roth was tall and slim. Because she possessed the empathic ability to sense danger in the offing, she was, by Deathland's definition, a mutie. Her fiery mane of thick red hair was the outward manifestation of her mutation, stirring, curling, moving, as if it were a separate, sentient organism. Christy was also gifted with a power that had been passed down the female line of her family. The women were in tune with the electromagnetic energies of Gaia, the Great Earth Mother. By tapping into these energies, the geo-power field of the planet itself, Christy could gain superhuman strength for a limited time. Though Ryan was the group's undisputed leader, he and Christy were equal partners in their relationship. Though he rarely spoke of it openly, Ryan loved her fiercely. The other great love of his life was his 11-year-old son, Dean. The issue of a brief encounter between Ryan and a young woman named Sharona, Dean had been united with his father for only a short time. Recently, Ryan had enrolled the lad in the Brody School in Colorado, and he missed the boy far more than he had thought he would. He found himself thinking of his son often, concerned for his safety. But travel was hazardous, and the locational jumps unpredictable. So he bided his time to give Dean a chance for independent growth, to let him cope on his own. Ryan and his companions used the gateway chambers to make Matran's jumps. Though gateways were hidden in subterranean redoubts all over the continent, the vast majority were concentrated in the southwest. There was always an element of danger when using the gateways, since the destinations were random. As Doc had frequently pointed out, it was like deliberately jumping from a warm yet familiar frying pan into a potentially raging fire of unknown temperature. The last jump had deposited them in a redoubt on a Montana mountain plateau. It was, ironically enough, the first of the subterranean installations they had ever found. The century-old garish painting of Cerberus, the three-headed black hound, was still on the wall, though faded and peeling. Doc was adamant about not making another jump so soon, so the band of travelers decided to strike out overland to explore the area. Though the last time they had visited the region, they had been pursued by a warlike band of Sioux, they saw no trace of any tribesmen. They reached a small settlement nestled in the foothills of the mountain, and after staying there a day and a night, they purchased mounts and provisions and rode off cross-country. It wasn't as dangerous an undertaking as it seemed, since both J.B. and Ryan had skirted the fringes of the region years before with Traitor. Recalling rumors of a Freeville near Yellowstone, Ryan had made that their destination. At the base of the hill, the six companions quietly engaged in a war conference. Ryan quickly outlined the situation to his friends.
We've got 9 blasters between us. As far as I could tell, they've only got 2.
Wait, you want to stage an ambush?
Welcome to the Deathlands, Mildred.
I don't need to be reminded of where I am, John.
Do you have an exact plan in mind, my dear Ryan?
Yeah. Mildred, you're our best shot. Climb to the top of the hill and choose a target with my Steyr. When you pick it off, I'll ride out and engage them.
Why just you?
Because I'm the best horseman, Jack, and this maneuver will call for some fast and fancy riding.
Well, you may be the best horseman, but I'm the best horsewoman. I'm going with you.
Fine. Shoot to kill.
There's never any other way.
And what about the rest of us?
Mop up. Move in on foot after our charge. Here's my Steyr, Mildred. It's ready to go.
Half a league, half a league, half a league onward.
Huh?
Oh, nothing, my dear Jack. Just a phrase I picked up somewhere, I suppose.
Let's go. Slow.
Christy drew her .38 caliber Smith & Wesson 640 revolver. Ryan pulled his Sig Sauer P226 from his holster.
You loaded?
Did you want to double check?
No, I trust you. I just don't want one of these bastards to be dead to rights and then live just because we don't have the ammo.
That won't be a problem.
Right. I'll go to the right-hand foot of the bluff. You take the left. They will know which way to shoot. As soon as you hear Mildred fire, go full speed ahead. This has to be quick or we're dead.
Right. See you at the bottom, lover.
Count on it.
Damn it. Did I load? Shit! Pya!
Christy rode toward the pirates at full speed, each hoofbeat thundering through her body. Ryan galloped furiously to her right. He had been ready. He had a good 100-foot lead on her.
Damn it, damn it, damn it!
One of the pirates lay face down in the dust, thick red fluid leaking from a bullet-blasted skull. The other three men scrambled for their weapons. Christy brought her Smith & Wesson to bear, knowing she was too far away. One pirate snatched at a pony and started to haul the animal behind him. Christy passed the prairie schooner and continued to gallop toward the poplar break, determined not to allow the pirate to get astride a horse. The bearded freebooter with the Winchester paused in his running, turned, and drew the rifle to his shoulder. Christy felt the wind of displaced air as the slug flew by. She didn't push her luck. The pirate whirled, a thin trail of blood playing an arc against a nearby tree. A shape entered Christie's line of vision from her right. She reined in her horse and swung her pistol in a short arc. As the hammer fell, she realized it was Ryan, riding up abreast of her.
No!
The firing pin fell on an empty chamber. Ryan galloped past her without a word, as if Christie had done nothing more life-threatening than point a finger. For Christie, a wave of relief was swallowed up by overwhelming embarrassment and anger. The pirate cut in front of Christy. He was astride the pony, leaning over its neck. She recognized him as the Coldheart who had pissed on the Cheyenne man. Christy kicked the bay down into the creek bed, fumbling with her empty gun, not daring to holster the weapon for fear of dropping it. For a minute, it was a wild race, with her horse's long-legged stride overtaking the pony. Chunks of gravel and dirt flew in a shower in the wake of both galloping animals. The bay was gaining, and Christy felt a growing surge of triumph, which abated quickly when she remembered she was pursuing a murderous savage with a gun that couldn't be fired. She reined in her horse. The pirate, as though sensing his pursuer's predicament, slowed his mount, then cast a fierce, dark-eyed glance over his shoulder.
I've got you now, you bitch!
The pirate sharply yanked the pony's head up and around. Placing the blade of a knife between the decayed stumps of his teeth, he urged the pony on.
Damn it, turn around!
Christy just managed to get her mount to lunge to another gallop, but the pirate was already upon her. He leapt from his mount.
I've got you!
With a burst of power, Christy rolled, shoving the man off her back. She swung around on the ground and kicked out with her right leg. The chiseled silver point of her boot smashed into the man's mouth. Rotted teeth flew into the air, and blood spurted in liquid tendrils onto his chin. She struggled to get back on her feet.
You fucking bitch!
The pirate scrambled toward her, knife held for a downward thrust. Christy looked at the blue-rimmed hole in the pirate's temple. A red-edged, fist-sized cavity occupied the back of his head. The man's brain matter decorated a few square feet of rock. Weak-limbed and trembling, Christy tried to rise.
Ryan, nice shooting.
Why do you look so surprised, lover? You're still alive.
I appreciate you telling me that.
Thought you might.
By the time Ryan and Christy caught her horse and returned to the Windwag, Mildred had freed the woman, and Jack had cut loose the skinned Indian and covered him with a tarp. Doc and JB were standing a watchful guard, guns in hand. Doc's weapon of choice was an old, ornately engraved Lama. The commemorative Civil War-era weapon had two barrels and an adjustable hammer. Like a shotgun, it fired a single 63-caliber round, and like a revolver, it had a chambered cylinder holding nine 44-caliber bullets. A blanket was draped about the woman's shoulders, and Mildred knelt before her, offering her a tin cup. The contents had been poured from a nearby earthenware jug.
Here, drink up. This might help to steady you some.
From what Ryan could see of the woman, she didn't need steadying. She stared straight ahead, her blue eyes unblinking, her face expressionless. She took the cup. Ryan gauged her age at 20-something, though she could have been younger. The pair of pirates lay where Ryan and Mildred's shots had hammered them. Mildred had delivered a fatal head wound to one, and the other, lying on his side, had two holes in his torso. The ground around him was clotted with blood, bone fragments, and bits of pink tissue that Ryan identified as his lungs. Christy gestured to the poplar brake.
One got away from me.
Well, let's make sure he won't be getting up.
Christy turned her bay to follow. Ryan noticed how she rubbed her ribcage and grimaced. She had taken a hard fall, perhaps even cracked a bone or two, but she wasn't complaining.
There's blood on the ground. It's fresh, from the one you backshot.
The trail of blood extended a few yards, then terminated at the bole of a tree. The bearded pirate sat against it, his face wet with sweat, but locked in a mask of defiance and hate. He had his hands clasped over a hole in his midsection, where the 38-caliber slug had exited, and blood dribbled between his fingers. Ryan and Christy stood and stared at the man for a long moment.
Well, he's not getting any younger.
Neither are you, Stoop.
Once Jack and the rest of the cadre start howling along your track, you ain't got much to look forward to. You were that hell-haired, gaudy slut.
Christy's hair betrayed her reflexive anger, and the pirate grinned at the hollow bore with red-filmed teeth.
Where's Hatchet Jack now?
Oh, you think I'd tell you? Jimmy would be fucked one eye.
No, I think I'd rather leave you here for the wolves to find. Won't be long, and you can spend the last few minutes of your life watching them unwind your guts.
Fear replaced the defiance in the pirate's eyes. A gutshot man could live for a long time, consumed with agony, provided the scent of blood and ruptured internal organs didn't draw predators. A death inflicted by razor-keen fangs and rending talons might be quick, but it was by no means painless.
Hey, woman.
What? Bastard!
The pirate's broad forehead sprouted a neat blue-ringed hole. The back of his head broke apart, sending skull shards, blood, and grayish-pink brain matter splattering against the bark of the tree. Ryan shoved his gun back into its holster. The scar on his face glowed like a bolt of angry lightning.
Let's get back while we still have some daylight.
Yeah.
Christy wiped away the blood and saliva from her face and repressed a shudder. They rode back through the trees, neither of them speaking. Christy moved quickly, as if she didn't want to ride beside him, and Ryan knew the reason why. More than once she had cautioned him about allowing a quick flare of rage to consume him, to control him. Ryan had agreed with her that surrendering to murderous fury could easily be counterproductive to breathing, and he'd gone to great effort to bring those surges of berserk anger under control. However, he couldn't and wouldn't tolerate the kind of swaggering scorn displayed by the likes of the pirate. In the past, especially during his years with a trader, men had died under his gun or knife, and sometimes his bare hands, for far less. He knew his rare bursts of homicidal rage frightened Christy, and sometimes even himself, and he also knew his swift execution of the pirate bothered her. Though Ryan and Christy shared more similarities than differences, she would never commit murder unless her life or the lives of those she loved was directly threatened. When Ryan and Christy emerged from the grove, they saw that all the corpses had been moved to the far side of the little valley. Mildred was doing her best to make the woman comfortable, though she was still unresponsive. JB looked up from examining the fuel tank of the Windwag's ancient diesel motor.
It's about a quarter full. It holds 20 or so gallons, and it probably gets about that many miles to the gallon, so they haven't strayed too far from the fleet and their supply boats.
Right. Mildred, how's she doing?
A few bruises and abrasions. Nothing serious. She's in shock, though.
We need to know where she came from, and if she lives with one of the Indian tribes in the area.
Amicus. We came from Amicus.
The woman spoke without looking at Ryan.
Amicus? That's where we're headed. We weren't sure if it really existed. What's your name?
The woman's eyes were blank. Ryan recognized the symptoms of a person who had undergone such terror and witnessed such horror that all emotions were frozen, locked deep within the soul. He could see the pain in her eyes, the memory of it fresh and frightful. She held her body in the stiff posture that came as a result of pain and of a fear that it would return.
Look, we need our questions answered. You need to guide us to Amicus and to tell us how and when the Red Cadre jumped you. That'll give us an idea of how close the rest of them are, okay? Hey, wake up!
Ryan! Oh, there, it's okay.
Christy joined Mildred with the woman. She sat beside her, massaging her neck and shoulders, trying to knead the tension out of them. She had been trained long ago in massage therapy of how to use subtle pressures to block pain and allow rigid muscles to relax. Ryan rose and left the woman to the gentle ministrations of Mildred and Christy.
I do not believe your bedside manner met with Dr. Wyeth's approval.
Got no time to cuddle someone who can walk and talk. Jack, you see anything?
See the wax tracks. Came from the southeast. Could backtrack them.
No time for a wreck before sundown. The cadre might miss these four and send out a search party. I don't much like the idea of meeting them in the dark. Hey, she found her tongue yet?
Fuck you, son of a bitch. What kind of a monster are you slapping me?
Yeah, you still got some fight in you. That's good. After all you've been through, I'm glad to see life in your eyes again.
I... Thank you.
What's your name?
Felicity.
How far is it to Amicus from here?
Take my hand.
Thank you.
I'm Mildred. This is Christy.
Hello, Felicity.
JB.
Howdy.
Jack.
Hey.
Doc.
An absolute pleasure. I only wish we had met in better circumstances.
And you've met Ryan.
Yes. Mildred, Amicus is about 20 miles that way.
What were you doing out here?
The young woman patently ignored Ryan.
Fine, whatever. Mildred?
Felicity, what were you doing out here?
I was out here hunting buffalo with my husband. We were attacked before we could start the butchering, about 2 hours ago.
Your husband was the Indian?
Spotted Hawk. A lot of the Cheyenne and the Lakota Sioux live in Amicus.
Felicity, can you guide us there?
I will.
Thank you.
Hey, Ryan?
Yeah, Jack?
Found something. One had this on him.
What is it?
Take a look.
Jack handed over a small packet bound by oilcloth and twine. Ryan untied the twine and withdrew a square of paper. He opened it, careful not to tear it along the creases. The sheet of parchment seemed ready to fall apart with age and use. He looked over the drawings it bore and realized it was some kind of map. The written words were unpronounceable.
What the hell? Jeanne Rock? Meister Mon... Montagnax?
By the three Kennedys, that's French! But it is certainly rare to see any evidence of the French this far north. Historically, only Louisiana had any French culture to speak of. Isn't that right, Jack?
Still does.
Allow me to peruse the document.
Well?
It seems to be a map of some kind. You might see there the dotted line marked Jean Roc.
Yeah. So it's a river?
The dotted line would lead me to believe so, yes. It's heading straight north, up to those sawtooths. Mystère Montano, my dear francophilic friend. The mountains of mystery.
Huh. Probably a map of prime hunting grounds. Let's move out. We're wasting daylight.
Doc and Ryan unsaddled the horses and piled the tack in the stern of the Windwag. The bridles were left on, but the bits were removed from their mouths. Jack fashioned a long lead from the reins and a length of rawhide he found in the wag, securing one end to a cleat at the rear of the craft. The body of Spotted Hawk was placed in the bow. The corpses of the pirates were left to the scavengers.
All right, everybody, let's start this thing.
JB approached the engine block and took the starting cord in one hand.
All right, everybody, hold your horses.
After the third failure, JB went back to tinkering, checking the plugs, the coil wires, and the oil level. Then he grasped the cord again, obviously steeling himself for another failure. Despite his impatience to get moving, Ryan couldn't help but smile.
Hey, all right. All aboard. Christy, Doc, spread the sail.
The rusty industrial fan nearly blew JB's fedora right off his head. The heavy sheet of broadcloth slowly caught the wind and billowed out. Almost in spite of itself, the schooner slowly rolled forward. Ryan managed to figure out how to steer the ungainly craft with a crude wheel, and Doc, who had more boating experience than any of them, dealt with the sail, making sure it didn't swell up with the artificially generated wind and rip loose from the rigging. As it was, he nearly brained Mildred by swinging the boom to and fro.
Hey, watch it, you senile old goat!
1,000 pardons, madam!
By the time the craft gained speed and rolled out of the little valley, everyone was at ease within it. The Windwag entered a broad, nearly treeless vista of high plains. The engine noise was too loud to have a conversation, so Felicity gave directions, mostly by hand signal. The wag sailed on, bouncing over ruts and rocks, the terrain changing very little. The area was filled with the ruins of old farms. Every mile or so, they spotted a barn, leaning red and rickety on itself, its roof cocked sideways, tarred shingles flapping in the breeze. As the sky began to darken with approaching twilight, Ryan became concerned. He didn't fancy camping out on the plains, especially in one of the ruined barns or farmhouses. But there was very little other cover available. Turning over the steerage controls to Christy, he scanned the horizon in all directions for a collection of trees or even a good-sized boulder. What he saw instead was a faint smudge of wispy gray against the deep azure of the sky. Though it was too distant to make an accurate judgment, he guessed the smudge wasn't smoke. It was trail dust. Withdrawing a battered set of compact binoculars from his saddlebag, he went portside and squinted through the lenses. A little less than half a mile off, he saw 4 prairie schooners rolling in a fast, tight formation. They were several times larger than the companion's own wag, and Ryan supposed that theirs was a scout craft of some type. The bows of the approaching vessels were pointed on an intercept course. He was able to make out a man standing at the bow of the center craft, a set of binoculars lifted to his eyes. Though he was too far away to pick out details beyond a mane of blonde hair, Ryan was positive that the man lowered the binoculars for a second and flashed him a gap-toothed grin. Sweeping the lenses across the 4 wags, Ryan made a quick head count. At least 50 figures appeared to be aboard the quartet of schooners. They were all long-haired and armed with knives, swords, and muskets. From the top of each mast fluttered the crimson skull standard.
Fire blast.
JB, can you make this thing go any faster?
No way! And we're almost out of gas!
Great.
Ryan's hands tightened on the steerage, hoping his grip alone would coax at least one more mile out of the craft. He didn't look behind him, focusing instead on the dark bulk of 2 hills a mile or so ahead. According to Felicity, the Ville of Amicus lay on the other side of the hills, through a narrow gorge running between them. A steady breeze still blew from behind them. It wasn't very strong, but the current was powerful enough to keep the sail half-filled and the Windwag moving. Still, it slowed. Ryan glanced over his shoulder. Strung out across the darkening horizon were four white shapes, the full sails of the Red Cadre's prairie schooners. They were gaining fast.
Ryan, we need to get rid of some weight.
Felicity's eyes flashed in sudden fear. Ryan knew that she realized the most obvious way to jettison was the body of her husband.
Cut the horses loose, Jack. They're ready to drop anyway.
Rat!
Felicity said nothing, but she directed a look of silent thanks toward Jack. He moved aft and sliced through the rawhide lead, attaching the animals to the wag. Doc came to Ryan's side, eyeing the hills ahead.
If the wind does not drop or change direction, we may make it, even at this speed.
The light of a quarter moon peeped over the rim of the world, staining the dark sky with a silver halo. Inexorably, the pursuing prairie schooners drew closer.
Christy, take the controls!
Okay!
Ryan made his way aft and peered through the binoculars again, hoping to pick out more details of their pursuers, since the lead craft was only 100 or so yards behind them. Tightening the focus on the center wag, he saw a black-bearded man shouldering a short, blunt-barreled object. Though it had a rifle stock, it was far too bulky and spike-nosed to be a rifle. When the deep hollow bore aligned itself with the rear of their craft, recognition rushed through Ryan like a flow of icy water. The pirate was aiming an old M79 grenade launcher. The maximum range of the 40-millimeter high-explosive round was 350 yards, and they were well within its field of effect. Though the M79 and its ammunition were probably 120 years old, they couldn't rely on a misfire.
Christy! Hard to port!
Their wag drifted sideways, the maneuver seeming to be maddeningly slow and clumsy. The dark bore of the grenade launcher spouted a puff of white smoke.
JB!
I'm on it!
JB checked the selector switch on his Uzi and flipped it to full auto.
I hate to say this, my dear Ryan, but...
The wind just died.
Right.
Come on, come on!
No one needed to be told what to do. They all snatched up their possessions and jumped overboard. The blanket dropped from Felicity's shoulders, and she ran naked toward the hills with a steady lightness and sureness of stride that came of long practice.
Keep running! We can make it!
I fear that I may...
Let's talk, Doc. More run!
Come on! Faster! Faster!
Felicity, in the lead, altered direction, heading for the tumble of rocks at the foot of the nearest hill. They followed her, running across stone-strewed ground. They dodged among larger rocks. The pain of a stitch stabbed along Ryan's left side. The muscles of his legs felt as if they were caught in a tightening vise. Nevertheless, he kept running, stumbling, and lurching from boulder to boulder.
Okay, Anita, go up!
Streaks of black cut through the sky as arrows shot from the rocks and into the chasing wags. Ryan looked over his shoulder, catching a brief glimpse of the wind wags sluggishly changing course, one barely avoiding a collision with another. The wooden hulls of all four craft bristled with feathered shafts.
We're almost there! Come on!
They followed Felicity's flashing nude figure as she picked a path between low rock tumbles and emerged into a narrow pass, the sides of the two hills rising on either side. Ryan and his people stood and swayed, trying to regain their breath and slow the rapid hammering of their hearts. Though the light was uncertain, Ryan saw a half-dozen men, and an odd collection they were. Some of them were Amerindians, their long dark hair bedecked with feathers. They wore a combination of deerskin tunics, breech clouts, and jeans. The other men, though white, were similarly dressed. All of them were armed with bows and quivers of arrows. The only gun was a long-barreled muzzleloader, and it was in the hands of a stocky, black-bearded white man who wore boot moccasins and a long-billed cap bearing the faded insignia of some pre-dark sports team. Felicity rushed up to this man and whispered into his ear. The man kept watchful eyes on Ryan and his friends as he listened to whatever Felicity was saying. Whenever she was done, he gave her a quick hug and strode toward Ryan, extending a hand.
My name is Moose Autry. Welcome to Amicus.
Ryan Carter. I am pleased to make your acquaintance. Behind me are Christy Roth, J.B. Dix, Doc Tanner, Jack Lauren, and Mildred Wyeth.
Thank you. Thank you all for bringing Felicity back to us. She and Spotted Hawk were valuable members of our community. His loss will be mourned.
What about those pirate sons of bitches? They may take his body.
They may. Unfortunately, all forms of banditry are endemic to this region, including defilement of the dead. However, the cadre won't dare the pass at night. Felicity, Running Deer will have clothes for you. Now, if you will all follow me...
Arm around Felicity's shoulders, Autry started walking down the dark gorge. Ryan hesitated, exchanging quizzical glances with his friends. Then they fell into step behind the man. The pass sliced through the narrow hills. It curved this way and that, and all of them had trouble with its navigation. They were feeling weary and wanted to rest. The hair at Ryan's nape suddenly tingled and lifted. He looked quickly at Christy and saw that her sentient hair was lying loose and relaxed across her shoulders. Then he scanned the perpendicular sides of the gorge. They reared only 100 feet above the pass, and the sky was clear and dark beyond them. Something shifted soundlessly atop the crest of the right-hand ridge. Ryan's hand made a reflexive move to his Sig Sauer. Rimmed by the moonlight, the shifting shape resolved into a shaggy, four-legged figure. Though it was only in his field of vision for a fraction of a second, Ryan realized it was a coyote or a wolf. When it vanished, Ryan didn't relax. An eerie aura hung over the pass, as if the lupine shadow had been a symbol of savage events yet to come. The pass turned west, then opened up. Amicus lay before them in the moonlight. At first glance, even on the second, Amicus looked typical of thousands of frontier pesthole vills. A big lake spread in the center of the vill. On its shores was a jumble of tar paper shacks and teepees, as well as a couple of old pre-dark structures, probably outbuildings of a long-ago farm. Three or four huge fires sputtered in the dark. A narrow main street was choked with mud, the boardwalk rotted through and lined by canting houses. A row of outhouses occupied the city square. Even the big vegetable garden at the far end of the settlement looked untidy, what with its straggly bean and tomato poles and mounds of rotting compost rearing from the ground. A herd of perhaps 50 horses and mules jostled one another in a wide, cockeyed corral. Dogs of all shapes, sizes, and breeds ambled along the streets. The air smelled richly of pig and cattle manure.
Ah, the very best of domestic cologne.
I will join you all later. I have to tell my Spotted Hawk's mother about her son.
Here's our local public house. If we tell your story in there, it'll be all over Amicus within the hour. Save you from having to say the same thing over and over again.
Only a few people were inside, but the big room smelled of sweat, tobacco, and potent homemade whiskey. The two men stood on either side of the rough-hewn slab of pine that served as the bar. One, a scrawny fellow with a luxuriant waxed mustache, was obviously the tavern keeper. The other man had his back to the door, and all they could see of him was a massive leather-clad torso and the rear of a black-haired head. The big man turned, giving Ryan and his people a cool, appraising stare. He was an Amerindian, wearing a beaded diamond and triangle design on his shirt. It was the ancient symbol of the Sioux. His black hair hung in two braids halfway to his waist.
Hello, Micah. Little Mountain. I've come with some heroes.
Yeah? You want some beers?
Yeah. One for each of us.
Will do.
The Red Cadre butchered Spotted Hawk, and we're gonna do pretty much the same to Felicity. But these folks came riding down and chilled all four of them. They almost made it all the way back here in one of their boats before it ran out of gas.
Oh, shit. Chilling four and stealing one of their boats. Hatchet Jack will slit you from crotch to eyeball with a dull deer antler. He'll burn this place to the ground to get you.
Oh, shut up, Micah. The cadre knows better than to molest us.
Why is that?
Amicus does too much trade with the local Cheyenne and Lakota. Too many of the tribes live here, at least part of the year. Like Little Mountain right there.
Little Mountain was staring hard at them, in a way most Indians would have considered impolite. Ryan met that stare. The man blinked, then touched his left eye.
Ochine!
He said one eye. Little Mountain isn't fluent in English.
The big man turned to Autry and spoke quickly in Lakota. Autry's face registered surprise.
Little Mountain says he knows of all of you, claims his chief met you, and that you're mighty warriors.
Yeah, we've met a number of tribesmen over the years, Ryan and I particularly. Who's the chief?
Yutankin,
Mahipia.
Hmm. Never heard of him. Guess we should have known his chief.
Is he going to be okay with the Red Cadre out there?
He can take care of himself. Guess he's not worried.
Well, maybe he's not, but I am. Will the Cadre bottle up the pass? Are they that vengeful?
Hatchet Jack has that reputation. All of you are free to enjoy our hospitality for as long as you care to do so. I'll find you comfortable quarters.
What's the population of Amicus?
It shifts with the seasons. We're at our most crowded when the buffalo hunters follow the herds, but it's too early for that. Right at the moment, we probably have 100 permanent residents.
Out of that number, how many are of fighting age?
Hard to say. My guess would be around 30, maybe 40.
And blasters? How many in town, and what type?
What's the point of these questions?
The point is that a pack of blood-drunk coldhearts is camping outside your vill. Now, I'm not sure of their arsenal, but they have at least one Gren launcher. If it comes down to a face-off, we need to know what you can throw against them.
Muzzle loaders, primarily. Old man Haslick is our gunsmith. Makes gunpowder, bullets, and so forth. He may know if there are more advanced blasters in town. Personally, I was never interested enough to make an inventory.
If I were you, I'd get interested, quick.
Do you think they'll attack us to get at you?
Hell yeah, if Hatchet Jack has a mind that these folks owe him a blood debt.
How come you know about him?
Go ahead, Micah, you tell him.
Well, for a few years, the Cadre used Amicus as a sort of winter camp. They behaved pretty well while they were here. One day, they raided the wrong Cheyenne village. The warriors tracked them down, waited in ambush outside the pass, and chilled damn near half of them. Hatchet Jack blamed me for not warning him, for setting him up.
And were you innocent of blame?
No, it was politics, you see. Amicus relies too heavily on the goodwill of the Cheyenne. If we alienated them, we would have alienated the Sioux, the Arapaho, and the Crow as well. Not only would the trade with them have ended, they would have razed the town to make it useless to the Cadre as a base. I had no choice but to cooperate with the ambush.
Sounds like the Red Cadre owes Amicus more of a blood debt than us.
Too true. And Hatchet Jack may use you six as the reason he needs to finally collect. Two debts collected for the price of one.
Unless you made a preemptive strike.
No, that's not our way. Not our way at all. Amicus came together 10 years ago as an experiment in communal cooperative living. If we start chilling people we disagree with, we'll be no different than any other frontierville.
Admirable ideals, Mr. Autry. However, judging by what you just told us, more honored in the breach. You allowed the local Indian tribes to solve your pirate problem.
Enough of this for tonight. I'm certain you're hungry and tired. Let me show you to your quarters, and I'll arrange for food to be brought to you.
They went with Autry back out onto the muddy, rutted strip that passed as Amicus's main street. Faces filled all the doorways as they walked by. Mainly children's faces and women's faces, some of them young and pretty. Most of them seamed and smoke-colored.
The hills must be crawling with wolves.
They're talking to us.
What do you mean?
Wolves are highly respected by most of the tribes. They're regarded as allies, talking to people, telling them what's going to happen.
And if you do not happen to speak wolf-ese, I suppose you are out of luck.
Not necessarily. I understand them, sometimes. Right now, they're talking about you.
Autry led them to a dilapidated building with a stone facade.
Amicus doesn't have an inn as such, but this place serves as a visitor's hostel.
The interior of the building was warm and smoky, with a floor of hand-hewn planks and walls shored up with heavy, smoke-blackened beams. A cast-iron stove glowed in one corner of the common room, its pipe disappearing into the adobe ceiling.
3 bedrooms. Afraid you'll have to double up. I'll arrange for supper and breakfast. We'll talk more tomorrow. Good night.
Ryan was in Front Royal, riding across his father's green meadows. He was 12 years old and mounted on Witch, his favorite pony. He had both of his eyes, and he saw that Baron Carter was still alive and waving to him from the top of a gently rolling hill.
All right! Come on, Witch! Let's go! Yeah! Witch! Come on, Witch! We gotta meet my dad!
The pony Ryan rode started to shift and morph. Suddenly, he was riding on a giant, dark gray wolf.
What? Daddy!
Coming to a halt, the wolf turned its huge head and eyed Ryan.
Hush. You've been here before, Manling. It's time to take you to a new place.
The wolf turned and loped away from the hill. Ryan looked behind him and saw his father standing there, receding swiftly in the distance. When he turned, he was a grown man again, but he still had both of his eyes. He knew the wolf was responsible for this gift, and gratitude welled up within him.
I can see.
You always could. You do not need eyes to see. Now we travel.
Where are we?
We are here at the end of the world. When the bombs fell, look around you.
It's all so chaotic.
All around them were monstrous mushroom clouds, rising in roaring columns toward heaven, flashing and flickering with hellish light. They loped past ruined cities overgrown with vegetation and bounded over fetid swamps. Overhead, a boiling, glowing belt of radioactive dust scorched across the sky. And everywhere, there was death. Corpses and animated cadavers with their flesh peeled and blistered, their internal organs hanging out, boiled and burst. They reached out with skeletal fingers, and Ryan recognized some of them. There was Lori and O'Mara, Hunniker and Oki, and all the crew from Warwag 1 and 2, and all the people he had killed. And there were the billions who had died in the nuke cost, their empty eye sockets weeping gelatinous tears. They hadn't been meant to die. Deathlands wasn't supposed to have happened.
They're dead. Everything. Everybody is dead. Dead.
The dead will live forever if they die inside a circle.
A circle?
There are four circles of life. We are passing through the fourth and last circle. We will go to the beginnings of the first circle.
Why?
So you may see what you have never seen.
On the far horizon, Ryan saw a glimmering of light breaking through the black curtain of the Deathlands. The light spread out over the horizon, like a warm wave, so bright, so brilliant, so blinding. Ryan had no choice but to close his eyes. He could still see the light, green and orange, yellow and red, spreading out, sweeping across Deathlands, changing it, transforming it, transforming it.
What time is it? 8:30.
Ryan's eye patch still covered his left eye, and he had slept in his clothes except for his boots. Christy had to have pulled them off after he had fallen asleep. He pushed the residue of the dream into the back of his mind, except it hadn't felt like a dream. Not even like the hallucinatory, almost real illusions he occasionally experienced after a particularly rough gateway transfer. Smelling bacon from the common room, Ryan stuffed his feet into his boots and quickly laced them up. He felt hungry and thirsty. The others were sitting around a table, laden with platters of food.
Morning, Ryan. Oh, that's bad.
That cup's for you, Ryan.
Is it what JB's having?
Yeah, it's some kind of tea. Have a seat.
That's strong.
The platters contained loaves of bread, fatty, blistered strips of bacon, and crumbling wedges of cheese. He hacked off a hunk of the wedge with a knife and chewed it slowly, the cheese so sharp it made his sinuses ache.
Damn! Shit!
A large, half-chewed hunk of bacon hit Jack's plate.
If they plan to kill us, this food is the simplest way.
Christy and Doc were silent, nibbling on crusts of bread and nursing cups of tea, their eyes downcast.
What's with you two?
We took a walking tour of Amicus this morning.
And?
And this is not salubrious ground. As His Honor the Mayor indicated, the populace is now aware of the circumstances that brought us here. They are displeased about our being encamped on their front doorstep.
They hold us responsible. They want us to leave.
Someone told you that?
They did not need to voice it. Their desire is evident in the backs turned to us, the fish-eyed stares, and the all-around frigid temperatures of their shoulders.
Well, fuck 'em. We leave.
It may not be easy. The Red Cadre has bottled up the main way in and out.
There's gotta be a back door.
There is, but it won't solve the immediate problem.
Mose Autry leaned against the doorframe. His face was drawn and pale with worry.
Dark night. How the hell did you get in this shack without making any noise?
Oh, you can't live around Amerindians without learning a few tricks here and there. Anyway, the Cadre hasn't made any overtures yet, but the guards at the pass tell me the fleet is tied up a quarter mile away.
So why can't we go out the rear exit?
If it's you Hatchet Jack is after, he'll take vengeance on Amicus for providing you sanctuary. Whether you're here or not, he'll expect blood to be paid in blood.
I thought you said he was afraid of pissing off the local Indians.
He's more afraid of losing face with his crew. As it is, even our resident tribesmen are afraid to leave town and go hunting. He might decide to sit tight and try to starve us out.
A typical tactic. But let's hear what he has to say before scaring ourselves with what-ifs.
Yes, but what if he wants you six in exchange for leaving us alone?
Let's hear what he has to say before thinking that. Now, show me around so I can get an idea of how defensible this place is.
That will not take long.
After visiting the outhouse behind the hostel, Ryan went with Autry through the ville. Amicus lay in fairly open country, in a swale between several broad low hills. There were no walls, and the only barrier to an incursion from the rear was a great tangled heap of mottled bones, the remains of all kinds of animals, from trout to mucksucker to buffalo. The people they encountered gave Ryan sullen up-from-under stares. There were many Amerindians in the settlement, but most of them appeared to be old women and children. They completed the circuit at a low, squat adobe building with a nearby tent. Under the tent was a forge, a crude smelter, work tables, and a clean, ruddy-faced old man. His alert face shone with sincerity, only to be betrayed by the avarice in his eyes when he spied the six-hour at Ryan's hip.
Ryan, this is Haslick. Haslick Ryan.
Make you gun and give you powder and ball, okay? Make you trade for your blaster, okay?
No, okay. Ryan examined one of Haslick's rifles from a stack propped up against the building. It was a home-built, single-shot flintlock, made of cold-rolled steel, a few brass alloy fittings, and a walnut stock. On a table lay several flintlock pistols. The workmanship wasn't spectacular, but it was adequate. Ryan had seen better, and far worse, though J.B. might disagree.
What other kinds of blasters are in town?
I think Bobby Mayhew has an old AK-47. No ammo for it, though. Mrs. Red Bear used to have a Ruger Blackhawk revolver and an HK-VP-70. No, that's right. She sold it.
What's inside?
Materials.
How much? Gunpowder?
Three casks of charcoal and sulfur. Some kegs for gunpowder. Make you trade?
You ever trade with the Red Cadre?
Sometimes. Sometimes the Hatchet Jack don't want to trade. Want to take.
You let him?
Oh, I let him take, okay. It's either that or...
Right. Thanks. Ryan and Autry returned to the street.
Not much to work with, is it?
Not much, no.
Hey! You want to make a trade, you come back, okay?
Then you can understand why we've never made a stand against the Cadre.
It's never bad to have an idea of your available arsenal. Not too long ago, a gang of marauding stickies took over a ville in Colorado, a place named Harmony. The folks there knew the gang was coming, but they didn't prepare. I guess they figured if they didn't prepare, the gang would leave them alone. An old friend of mine used to say, "Ain't no virtue in hoping for the best when the worst is on its way."
What happened?
Pretty much what you'd expect to happen. The muties chilled a lot of innocent people and took over the ville, used it as a base to launch their raids. Sound familiar?
What happened to the gang?
Me and my friends chilled the whole lot of them. Didn't take long.
Why not?
Because we were prepared.
Interesting analogy, Mr. Cawdor.
The way I see it, if...
Mr. Mose, got news!
What is it, William?
Hatchy Captain Jack sent word. He wants to parley at noon.
Autry's face went the color of old ashes, but he showed no emotion otherwise.
Where?
In the pass. Said he'll come under a flag of truce.
I see. Ryan, under the circumstances, you'll forgive me if I leave you to your own...
Not with you, Mr. Rose. With him.
The boy pointed to Ryan.
Well, I see. Ryan, there's no reason for you to meet with him, though perhaps you may be able to defuse any hostilities. I can't force you, but I can ask. Will you meet with him?
I'll do it, but the hostilities are already out in the open. I doubt a face-to-face palaver will close them up. Could make things worse.
I doubt that's possible.
Believe me, Mr. Autry, it is.